From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Both President Trump and Joe Biden are campaigning in Minnesota today as early voting begins there. Last night, in separate events, the two presidential candidates focused their campaigns in very different ways.
Biden will hand the left-wing mob the keys to your kids' classroom.
I really do view this campaign as a campaign between Scranton and Park Avenue.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News, and Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. Welcome to both of you. This week, we saw both President Trump and Joe Biden face undecided voters, something they haven't done in a long time. Last night, it was Biden's turn in a CNN town hall where he called Trump's response to the pandemic criminal and totally irresponsible. Listen.
We have to be honest with the American people. They're tough. They know, as Franklin Roosevelt said, things get worse and worse before they get better and better. But you got to level with the American people, shoot from the shoulder. There's never been a time they've not been able to step up. This president should step down.
Beth, how did Biden do last night as he faced voters who were undecided?
Well, he got a pretty good reception. People seem very willing to listen to him and receptive to his message, whereas President Trump earlier in the week really got hit by a lot of pretty tough questions. He doesn't typically sit for that type of interview, so it was noteworthy to see him taking questions from people who weren't automatically willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on the economy and on COVID and other things. So far, Biden has done a pretty good job staying focused. He's not being pulled off into directions that his campaign insists are not the major issues of the campaign. He's staying on message about the pandemic, on the economy. That clip you just played where he said it's Scranton versus Wall Street. Very interesting. He's sort of flipping the traditional script. Usually conservatives, Republicans say they portray Democrats as the party of the elite. And right now, Biden's trying to say that actually Republicans and President Trump represent those interests.
Scott Wong, let me go to you. We heard Tanya set up at the top that these candidates are focusing their campaigns in very different ways. That is certainly the case. But I wonder if that is where most voters are right now, that they're either full on in Trump camp or full on in Biden camp, and there's not a whole lot in the middle right now.
Well, there probably is not a whole lot in the middle, but the middle is sort of what's going to decide this election. And if for the people who have not made up their minds already, they're taking a close look at events like these, like the ABC town hall with President Trump, where he stumbled through a few of those healthcare questions from undecided voters, as well as Joe Biden just yesterday. And so, you know, it looks like President Trump continues to try to appeal to his base. He's, you know, for example, yesterday rolled out what he called his pro-America education plan, which really was something that was trying to appeal more towards his base. I think with Joe Biden, you're seeing more an appeal to those centrist voters. And so, you know, that's really sort of where the difference is between these two candidates. You're going to hear over and over, as you did last night, about this whole framing from Joe Biden and his people, Scranton versus Park Avenue. Joe Biden really wants to hammer home that he is a guy of the people. He's there representing the little people and is going to be talking a lot about his Scranton roots and portraying President Trump as somebody who grew up pretty wealthy and was handed a lot of things to him in his life.
And we probably will expect to hear more of that during the first debates, which are on September 29th. President Trump says he's preparing for the debates by doing what he does every day. Biden says he's preparing to push back on the false statements that the president has made. Beth, what are you expecting to see and hear in this first debate on the 29th?
Well, you can only imagine how this is going to be the TV show of the century, to see the two of them finally come together in this campaign that is just so fraught for so many Americans. Look, President Trump's been through this once. He debated Hillary Clinton three times in 2016. And even though, generally speaking, most analysts thought Hillary Clinton won all three debates, Trump went on to win the election. So they're not necessarily all that predictive. But he has been through this at a presidential level. Joe Biden Bryant has debated twice as a vice presidential nominee, once with Sarah Palin and once with Paul Ryan. Generally speaking, he got good marks at both of those debates, but that was 12 years ago. So more than 12 years ago in the case of the Palin debate. So he could be a little rusty. We are hearing that he is practicing quite intensively and is taking the prep very seriously, whereas President Trump is probably going to wing it a little more. And those false statements, we do know that President Trump has a habit of sort of plunging into things that aren't necessarily true. So how much time Biden spends correcting Trump versus making his own case is going to be a little bit of a tricky balance for Biden.
You know, also a big issue right now is the coronavirus, and President Trump continues to come under fire for his response to that. Vice President Pence's former lead staffer, Olivia Choi, was on the coronavirus task force, and she's now saying that she's going to vote for Joe Biden. There's actually a video where Choi, who is a lifelong Republican, says the president only cares about getting reelected, not about leading the nation through a pandemic. Let's listen.
Towards the middle of February, we knew it wasn't a matter of if COVID would become a big pandemic here in the United States. It was a matter of when. But the president didn't want to hear that because his biggest concern was that we were in election year and how is this going to affect what he considered to be his record of success. It was shocking to see the president saying that the virus was a hoax, saying that everything's okay.
Very ominous music. Scott, what is the White House saying about this?
Well, the White House and specifically Vice President Pence, for whom this woman was a staffer, one of his top advisors, especially on the coronavirus pandemic, he is saying that, you know, she is somebody who is a disgruntled former employee who wanted to play politics during, you know, in the home stretch of an election year. But I think, you know, she follows a trend of ex-White House staffers. You know, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, and National Security Advisor John Bolton, who have spoken out and criticized the president's handling of a variety of issues, including the coronavirus pandemic. And so this follows a trend of people who saw the internal workings of the White House and have said, you know, this man is simply not fit to be president. It's damning, especially as it comes on the heels of the Bob Woodward revelations that said that had recordings showing that Trump admitted deliberately downplaying the dangers of COVID-19 because he said he didn't really want to create a panic in the public among Americans. And so this is yet another bad week for the president. And there's not that many days left before the election. Mm-hmm. People are already heading to the polls in places like North Carolina and Virginia and Minnesota, where the two candidates are today.
Scott, I thought you were going to say that Pence said that he didn't know her, his former top aide.
He definitely knew her because she was just disgruntled. There are a lot of photos of the two together, so he can't deny
it's hard to deny that. Beth, let's talk about what this all means for Senate races, because, of course, it's not just the presidency that's happening, the presidential election, but, of course, the control of the Senate is at stake. And there are new polls out today that show that Democratic Senate candidates in Maine, North Carolina, Arizona are leading the Republican challengers in those states. And a lot of that has to do with the president and his pandemic response. Is it dragging down Republicans?
Well, that's always going to be the case, that whomever is at the top of the ticket is either going to boost the candidates of his or her party or drag them down, depending on how that person at the top of the ticket is doing. Right now, President Trump is lagging behind in some of those states, and he is definitely producing a drag on people like Martha McSally in Arizona and Susan Collins up in Maine. But, you know, it's still early. We also know that, you know, balance in the Senate is going to depend very much on the race in Alabama, where a Democrat, Doug Jones, is likely to lose. So just because the Senate seats flip in certain states, if one flips back to Republicans on the other side, we could be getting very, very close to a 50-50 tie or a narrow Republican majority in the Senate, keeping Mitch McConnell in power.
There is word, Scott, that Congress, you know, may be a little closer at this point to a new coronavirus relief bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said there's still a massive need for it. She wants to keep lawmakers in town until they come up with something. And President Trump told Republicans to offer a more expensive bill themselves. What are you hearing about whether you think there will be another relief bill coming?
Well, time is really running out. They only have a couple more weeks that they're in session before they leave for the campaign trail. So the clock is ticking. However, I think the big development, as you hit on, was the president telling his own party and senators in his own party to get a bigger number in terms of coronavirus relief. That had really bailed out Speaker Nancy Pelosi because she was under fire from her own vulnerable Democrats who were saying, you got to get something for us. We're heading back to our districts and the campaign trail with nothing to show for. And President Trump bailed her out in a big way by saying, we need a deal and we need a big number.
That is Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. And we've been speaking with Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Firefighters are making progress battling several fires in Washington State, California, and Oregon. And residents who were forced to flee are slowly returning home. But for thousands of people in Oregon, their homes are no more. The fast-moving fires have almost leveled places in the southern part of the state, like Talent and Phoenix. Eric Newman joins us now from Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
And Eric, you've been out talking to people who are coming back to their neighborhoods and seeing that everything is basically gone. What are people sharing with you right now?
For the most part, people are sort of in shock. This is an event that has never really happened here in this community before. The fire was relatively small in size compared to other wildfires, but it really just tore through a fairly urban area. So like you said, there's whole communities that have been leveled, and I think people are still just trying to understand what that means for themselves and figure out how to rebuild.
Yes. We know that firefighters are working around the clock to suppress these fires, but there's also been this criticism of the county's emergency alert system. Did people get notified about evacuations?
Definitely not as many as would have liked to. That's one of the kind of new details that is emerging right now with this situation. It looks like the county here didn't send out emergency alerts to everyone when the fire was really going through the towns. And we don't really know exactly why that was, if that was a conscious decision. Officials have talked about how if everybody had left their houses at the same time, it could have just created gridlock in the streets everywhere. And an event where you had 2,300 homes burned down could have become even more dangerous. So there's really not a lot of answers about that right now. But yeah, there's sort of two different emergency alerts that do go out. One of them is a system where people opt in, where they'll sign up and they'll get text alerts on their phone. Those ones did go out, although it seems to be sort of intermittent who got the alerts and who didn't. And then there's sort of a bigger federal system that just is the one that overrides your TV and your radio and goes out to wireless alerts on your cell phones. And that alert was not sent out. So there's really a lot of questions right now about what happened with that.
You mentioned the number 2,300 homes, and that includes the towns of Talent and Phoenix, which are in the Rogue Valley region. It's almost really hard to wrap your head around this number. I mean, entire communities of primarily low-income residents have been destroyed. What are the long-term implications that this could have on the region? You've been a reporter there, and so you kind of know about some of those other underlining issues that happen in those communities, in particular, those who might not have the money or insurance to rebuild.
Yeah, that'll be sort of the long-term story of this incident. Basically, these are two communities that were some of the more affordable ones to live in this area. There was already a housing crisis here in the Rogue Valley. So I've spoken with people who were at mobile home parks where their entire community has been destroyed. I was at an evacuation center where there was residents from a senior living home that was destroyed. So these are all people that don't maybe have a ton of mobility and may not just have the resources to move up to another town somewhere else very easily. So there's there's a lot of, you know, questions about how this community is going to rebuild, how this could affect the homelessness issue that already is, where there already is an issue here in the area.
And then there's COVID-19.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is all happening in the midst of a pandemic. And that is an issue that already has really affected the budgets of a lot of these communities. The Rogue Valley is a tourist destination, so a lot of people come here for entertainment. That whole foundation of this area has been sort of shattered just in the last 6 months. So there's going to be a lot of trickle-down effects that nobody really knows the answer to right now. But those likely will be the things that stick with this area for quite a while.
How are evacuation shelters setting up environments to mitigate the possibility of people contracting COVID-19?
That is a challenge that I think people are just trying to figure out how to cope with right now, mostly because this more pressing tragedy has kind of put COVID out of a lot of people's minds. There's just a lot of those basic protocols that we've been told that we need to follow to prevent the spread of COVID-19, from sanitation, constantly washing your hands, to wearing masks, to social distancing, that is kind of out the window for a lot of people. So we'll see how this tragedy affects the pandemic in the coming weeks.
That's Eric Newman, a reporter with Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon. Eric, thank you so much for this update.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, we got news this week that Netflix has ordered a new animated version of the classic 1970s sitcom Good Times that follows word of another reboot of an old comedy coming to TV.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there, I'll tell you how I became...
That's right, Will Smith announced that a new dramatic version of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air has been picked up by NBC's streaming service Peacock. For more, we're joined by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So to refresh our listeners' memories, Good Times is the classic Norman Lear sitcom about a black family in Chicago. Let's listen to this scene where James Evans Sr. scolds his son, JJ.
As long as you're living under my roof, you ain't gonna do but one thing, and that's obey.
Who says I gotta live under your roof?
JJ! Oh, what you trying to say, Junior?
I'm saying maybe I ought to leave.
Oh, son, it's rough out there. You'd be back home before your suitcase stopped rocking.
So, Eric, how is Netflix planning to transform the show into an animated series?
Well, we don't know much. There was an announcement made. There's going to be 10 episodes and went straight to series. The executive producers are really interesting. In addition to Norman Lear, who, of course, helped create the original Good Times, Steph Curry, the NBA star, and Seth MacFarlane are going to be executive producers on this show. And it's going to be set in the present day. You know, I can only imagine the kinds of issues they'll tackle depicting a black family in a housing project in today's times.
Mm-hmm. And what about Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? This is also getting rebooted. This started with a viral 4-minute video reimagining the sitcom as a drama. Will Smith saw it, started pitching it, and then here he is announcing that it got picked up by NBC's new streaming service, Peacock.
We have just officially closed the deal with Peacock with an unprecedented 2-season order from a pitch.
Now, just to give people a sense of how unprecedented that is, I was talking to somebody who's in the TV industry last night, and he said, for every 10 pitches, one gets through. For every 10 of those that get through, only one gets made into a pilot. So this is very unusual.
Yeah, well, I mean, so many things sort of came together to make this happen. First of all, this is an amazing illustration of what you can achieve through online platforms. This talented young guy, his name's Morgan Cooper. He's the director and cinematographer, and he put together this sort of fake trailer for a series that didn't exist at that time, but he made it a much more dramatic and a contemporary look at the story of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And, you know, this year is the 30th anniversary. There seems to be a lot of nostalgia for that show anyway. The old cast is ready to start talking, and Will Smith was on board. It's just one of those showbiz things where all of these elements came coming together. And the trailer is really good. Let's check out a clip here where the Fresh Prince's mother is scolding him because he got into a fight on a basketball court. The cops intervened, and when they searched his bag, they found a gun. Let's check it out.
I've done my best, Will. But it's time for a change. You're going to Bel Air to live with your uncle and your auntie.
Bel Air, out of all places.
This is a second chance, Will. Don't waste it.
Will, I will not bail you out again. In this house, I'm not Uncle Phil. I'm the law.
Whoa.
And see, you can hear just how momentous that is. And, yeah. And you know, Will Smith recorded a video where he talked with Morgan Cooper, and he talked about how on the original sitcom, they couldn't really lean too hard into the serious aspects of the story. Now they get a chance to do something much more substantive and much more gritty.
So, Eric, it was just a few years ago that we had another one of these reboots, and it was Full House became Fuller House on Netflix, and the critics didn't really like it all that much. So is it risky to do something like this right now when you've got these very popular shows from the past and you try to do them in a different way?
Well, there's a ton of different revivals out there, and what I've noticed as a critic is the revivals that seem to connect with the old audience, the nostalgic audience, are the revivals that are the most like the show was when it was on the air. So even though critics didn't like Fuller House, it was one of Netflix's most watched originals. You know, doing a fresh version of an old show can be a little tricky, but in the case of The Fresh Prince, the advantage that they have is that the original star of the show has signed off on it and will be involved as an executive producer, which gives it quite a leg up, I think.
That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The Democratic Party is trying to win back Catholic voters across the country after years of losing support. Those efforts are particularly visible in one key swing state this fall, Pennsylvania. Lucy Perkins of member station WESA in Pittsburgh looks at why it will be hard for Democrats to retain Catholic voters this November, even with the ticket led by a Catholic presidential nominee.
On a beautiful late summer evening in southwestern Pennsylvania, Catholic voters gathered outdoors to rally for Joe Biden.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. It is so good to see you in person.
Democratic Congressman Connor Lamb tried to tell the group about how his Catholic faith shapes his work. But a group of nearby anti-abortion protesters interrupted Lamb, calling him an apostate and heretic.
Celebrate. Because those of you who sent a Democratic majority to Congress 2 years ago can be proud of several actual works to trying to help the most vulnerable in our society.
Lamb never mentioned abortion, but the issue is a polarizing one. Biden's a practicing Catholic, but he supports Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court ruling that guarantees the right to an abortion.
There is one phrase that reverberates throughout the Bible more times than any other, and that phrase is "be not afraid." Don't be afraid of this president. Don't be afraid of people who disagree with you. Certainly do not be afraid of your own neighbor.
Betsy Swainar of Point Breeze plans to follow Lamb's advice. She's a registered independent who says her faith has inspired her to vote for Democratic and Republican presidential candidates. Many Christians oppose abortion, but Catholics link the issue to a broader belief in the value of life, which for Swainar means also looking at issues like health care and climate change.
If you're voting as a Catholic, there's a group of like 12 to 15 issues, and you're supposed to look at all of them.
Swainar is in the minority. According to the Pew Research Center, Trump beat Hillary Clinton among Catholic voters in 2016 by 52% to 44%. Anita Theis of Butler County is one of them. She used to be a Democrat, but now she's one of the anti-abortion protesters at the rally.
The only reason that I will not vote for Joe Biden is because he says he's Catholic, but he's pro-abortion. You can't change the basic fundamentals of the Catholic faith. It teaches you, thou shalt not kill, period.
Theis says that leaves President Trump as the only choice for Catholics.
God bless him, but he's not presidential many times. In fact, he acts really like a jerk many times. But when it comes to the babies being killed, he is totally on board.
In southwestern Pennsylvania, Democrats and the Catholic Church were intertwined for decades. More than a century ago, mostly Catholic Eastern European immigrants found a home in the labor movement. Historians recall that churches served as headquarters for fledgling unions. When Democrats embraced the union cause, they earned generations of voters who backed the party on economic issues, but remained more conservative socially. These days, Republican political consultant Mike Devaney says the party is losing those voters as it moves left on social issues.
A lot of these culturally conservative Democrats, folks who have been registered Democrat and their family has been registered Democrat for generations, really are no longer finding a home here.
Devaney says if Biden wants to reverse that trend, he should campaign beyond urban centers. And he should expand the discussion of values to include how you treat others and the way a president should act. For Here and Now, I'm Lucy Perkins.
Architect Frank Gehry is 91 years old, but he's showing no signs of slowing down. He designed the new Dwight D. Eisenhower Memorial in Washington, D.C. that was dedicated yesterday. I spoke with him about that project and about his early career.
I was looking to make things a lot more cost-effective. I wasn't using fancy materials. I grew up, you know, very poor, so I was using corrugated metal, galvanized wood framing, and I think at some point that resonated with the architectural community anyway, and I was a curiosity, let's say, for a while, and slowly, you know, things happen. We did the Bilbao building.
That would be the Guggenheim Bilbao Museum. Frank Gehry also designed the Wiseman Art Museum in Minneapolis, the EMP Museum in Seattle, Beekman Tower in New York, and Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He's also designed a number of concert halls, including the Walt Disney Concert Hall in L.A. and the Pierre Boulez Salle Concert Hall in Berlin. As we continued our conversation, I asked Frank Gehry if he thinks he'll design another.
I love concert halls.
Yeah,
I love listening to music, all music, jazz and classical, and I love working with the musicians and the people. Usually the Philharmonic boards are fun to work with. I think creating a place where the building connects people and connects people to the musicians and vice versa. It's like stagecraft. It's like theater. You know, when you go to a good theater, you feel it. When you're an actor on stage, I've talked to many actors on, and myself, I've experienced giving lectures in halls where there's no connection between me as the lecturer and the audience. You feel like who's out there. And the trick, if you will, is Shakespeare. You know, all the world's a stage. All men are world. We're all players. I think that's the edict that I go by. I mean, everybody's in it. And when you listen to music, the audience, feeling of the audience by the musicians is very important.
Do you listen to music while you're working?
I used to a lot. Now I don't. I listen to music when I'm relaxing.
Why is that?
Because I've gotten more into the music, and when it's peripheral, it's not as interesting. I mean, it's nice as background, but I really like to listen to the musicians and the differences between the different pianists and the different and they are different. And over time, you get to recognize Daniel Barenboim the Gould guy, the guy that did the Goldberg variation, Glenn Gould. Yeah, I grew up in Canada, and Glenn Gould was a big deal when I was growing up as a kid.
What do you think of the architecture that you see today around you? Not the fancy stuff, but the stuff that's going up, the condo buildings that are going up all over the place that seem like they're just a template and, you know, the same in every city around this country.
And that's what they are. It's a commentary on us, I guess, on our lives and what we hold important and valuable. I think I'm sure that for a slight twist, you can create a better version, and it's not more expensive. But that's my battle cry. But you can't change people. It starts with who commissions the building and their values, and then the public's demands, I guess. The public doesn't demand better architecture. Most people aren't even aware of it.
And yet we're surrounded by it all the time, and it changes the spaces that we're in all day.
Right. But if you go to downtown anywhere, it looks the same, right? The same buildings are repeated in Seoul, Korea, as in Ohio or in Kansas City or wherever. Right. There seems to be a cookie-cutter thing that prevails. You know, some of them are interesting. I'd say maybe 20%. I'm being optimistic.
Well, what is a building that you love that you didn't design yourself?
Eric Mendelssohn Einstein Tower in Berlin is a beautiful building for what it is and where it sits and how it's placed. It's a masterpiece in placement in a urban setting. It's not an urban setting, but it's a bunch of buildings for astronomy with telescopes and things. And Mendelssohn managed to place it so that when you came up the hill, you walked a certain way and you were just naturally came in on axes. And it wasn't like an axial, you know, mandate. You didn't even realize it. You're coming out, and it was very subtle, and I love that. That's one of my favorite, but there are others.
If there is a young architect listening to this, Frank Gehry, who wants to be the next Frank Gehry, what would you tell them as a piece of advice?
Tell him to be the next himself. I think that's important. I think you have to, you know, when I start a class with students, I ask them to write their signature, and they each write their signature. And I spread them out, and I say, look, you all have a different aesthetic when you write your signature. That's you, that's you, that's you, that's you. So there is a you that comes naturally. So stick with it. Let it come naturally. Let your designs come naturally out of you, and you'll prevail and become who you are. Now, whether anybody's going to like it, I can't guarantee, but you know, somebody's going to like it somewhere. I remember an artist friend walking in the desert with Michael Heiser, who does big monumental sculptures. And it was midnight. We were walking out in the desert in Nevada looking at one of his sculptures. And I had just done the little house in Santa Monica. And he said to me, Frank, did it ever occur to you that if you made your buildings out of stronger materials that would last 2,000 years, somebody eventually will like it? I thought that was brilliant.
Well, and that actually brings me to another question, which is what has pushed you to keep going in the face of criticism, which I'm sure you've heard over the years of some of your buildings?
Well, I just, I can't be anybody else but me, and people hire me, so I assume that as long as they do, I do it. If they stop, then I won't. So I think the fact that somebody does call me and say, hey, will you work on this with me or help me? And I get enough of that to keep a big office going, a couple hundred people. So.
Well, and you're 91 years old now, but you are still very busy. We mentioned the Eisenhower Memorial, but what's your next project? What are you most excited about right now?
Oh, boy. It's like, which is your favorite child? You know? Then when you say it, then the other people call and say, I thought I was here.
Okay, well, how about this? What's one of the projects you're excited about right now that you're working on?
I'm working in Taiwan on a museum for medicine to show Eastern and Western medicine in a museum. And it's a beautiful site, and I'm trying to create a facade that with the natural light looks like a watercolor. I've done pieces of that before in other buildings, but this one is an opportunity to do it in a special way. So I'm excited about that.
Frank Carey, a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us and for everything that you have done and are doing in the world of architecture.
Thank you very much.
There's been a breakthrough recently in restoring coral off the coast of the Florida Keys. Scientists have gotten it to spawn more rapidly. And that's notable because much of the coral off the Florida Keys is dying. Sarah Fangman is superintendent of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
And Sarah, to remind everyone, coral spawns. It's not a plant, but a marine invertebrate. Scientists are using a technique called microfragmentation to get coral to reproduce. It's called reskinning. Give us the layperson's version of what this is.
Sure. So corals, as you noted, are animals. And a lot of people aren't aware of that because they kind of look like colorful rocks on the seafloor. They don't move and they form these big mounds. And so the reskinning technique that scientists have pioneered here in Florida involves taking tiny pieces of coral tissue, basically the skin of the rock, if you will, and taking duplicate little pieces of it. So pieces that are the same genetic material. And if you picture a little piece of coral tissue, like a piece of pepperoni on a pizza, and you place those all around that coral rock, if you will, that skeleton, then those little pieces start to grow. And each of those little pepperoni slices will grow into each other. And because they are genetically identical, they will become a single individual colony. And that colony can basically reproduce much more quickly than if that colony had started from a single individual growing naturally. And so naturally, a coral would take decades to get to the age where it could reproduce. But using this technique, scientists have discovered that they can get corals to reproduce in as few as 5 years, which is really fantastic given the state of our reefs around the world.
Coral die-off is this worldwide phenomenon. Why is it important for coral to be a part of the reef off of the Keys?
The reefs are important for a lot of reasons. Here in the Florida Keys, tourism is the largest economic driver. And people come here because they want to get in our beautiful turquoise water and they want to see our colorful, vibrant, alive reefs. They also provide tremendous fisheries. That's the second largest economic activity here in the Florida Keys. That's very important. But then also, these reefs provide coastal protection. So they are out there bringing those waves down as they come in from offshore and really helping us. Because down here in the Keys, these islands are very low-lying. We don't, you know, have a lot of room to climb up and get away from wave action. And so our reefs are helping to protect our coastline. So they provide a lot of services to us here in the Keys.
What's killing them?
A lot of things are hard for corals right now. Temperature stress is making it difficult for corals. Water quality is a challenge for corals. And then right now, here in Florida, we are experiencing an unprecedented multi-year coral disease event that is just devastating our reefs. So they're suffering from a whole lot of different impacts. And so it's a hard time to be a coral.
You're leading a 15-year, $100 million project to restore the coral. in light of everything that you just said, why do this with pollution and all of these other factors killing them and knowing that all of those factors aren't going away anytime soon?
That's a great question, and that is a question that gets asked a lot. Is it a waste of time to put out more corals when the corals that live there are dying? And the answer is we cannot afford to wait to solve those bigger problems. We need to be doing both. We need to be addressing climate change. We need to be making our water quality better. But we cannot wait until we solve those problems to also help the resilient and resistant corals that still exist to continue to survive out there. We need more of those genotypes, that genetic material on our reef. We cannot wait. We just cannot wait. The system is too important.
Hmm. One last question I want to ask you about. I mean, barrier reefs are rare in the U.S. Can you expound upon that in the context of the global issue that we're seeing around coral die-off?
The Florida Reef Tract is the only barrier reef system that we have in the United States. The only one. It's, in my view, on par with the Grand Canyon, with Yosemite, in terms of it being a national treasure. And they are in trouble, and we need people to know about it so they can help us make sure that we get all of these problems addressed that we're tackling. So I think that's why this is really important, because we don't have another shot at this.
Sarah Fangman is superintendent of the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. Thank you so much for this conversation, Sarah.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.